Good morning. Good morning. I am Dave, and I'm 175 on my best days. When I'm carrying little Emma, maybe I'd get 175. Now, turn to Ruth, chapter 4. We're going to just dive right in this morning. Eighth book in the Old Testament, if you don't know where to find it. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, and then Ruth. This little book that probably covers two pages in your Bible between Judges and 1 Samuel. Are you guys enjoying the story of Ruth so far? It's a great story, isn't it? I don't mean make-believe story. I mean, it's a great real story. It's a great, great real story about these faithful people. So our theme, the theme of this series is what? You're all Hebrew scholars, and the theme is? Chesed. Yes, it's this Hebrew word that means steadfast love, loyal love. It's a word that captures both love and commitment and sacrifice. It's a love that goes beyond the call of duty, beyond expectations. And I've been arguing that Ruth is not primarily a romance, but it's primarily an adventure or maybe a drama. And what I've meant by that is the overarching issue is not the romance that develops between Ruth and Boaz. The overarching issue is the problem of Naomi. It's this woman who has gone through this devastating loss, a series of losses in her life, and she's left without any men in her life and without a male heir to continue her husband's line. That's the driving force. That's what's driving the plot of this story. And so what we're seeing is this amazing chesed, this steadfast love that's being shown to Naomi, this woman in need. So just to remind you, we're going to look at chapter 4 this morning. Just to remind you, those of you that haven't been around, chapter 1, Naomi, this woman and her husband Elimelech, they end up leaving Israel with their two sons because there's a famine. They go to Moab. While in Moab, all three men die. And Naomi returns to Israel with her daughter-in-law, Ruth. And Ruth shows this amazing commitment to her mother-in-law. So they come back and they return to the land. And then in chapter 2, Ruth goes out to the fields to glean. We just heard about gleaning. Ruth gleaned thousands of years ago. It's a little bit tougher back then than it will be if you bring the kids out. But she goes out and gleans and basically provides for her mother-in-law, Naomi. And she meets this man, Boaz, who's a landowner who is related to Elimelech. And then last week, we looked at that scene where Naomi comes up with this plan that Ruth agrees to, that she shows up on the threshing floor at night at Boaz's feet and essentially indirectly proposes to him, which is as radical back then as it is today, and even more so for a younger woman to do that to an older man, especially a foreigner, to do that to an Israelite. And she says, I want to come under your care and protection. We want to come under your wings. And Boaz sees that act of faith, and he says, I'm going to do that for you. I would love to do that for you, but there's actually a relative who is closer to Elimelech than I am, and that is his right and his obligation. So we need to see if he's willing to do that, and if he isn't, I'm willing to do it. So we are left there. We are left in suspense, and I know this whole week you've been sitting in suspense, wondering, you've been biting your nails, wondering how this story is going to end. You read ahead. You can go home right now then, because I got nothing for you. So, we're going to finish off chapter 4. We actually have one more week on Ruth, but we're going to cover chapter 4 minus the genealogy at the end. Did you read through the genealogy? No? Okay. Huh, interesting. Okay. So, I'm going to start by reading verses 1 through 10. And then we'll go back over those verses, verse by verse, and then we'll cover the rest of the chapter towards the end. So Boaz has agreed to care for Ruth, but he's got to go see this other guy who's closer in line, blood-wise, to Elimelech. So I'm going to read verses 1 through 10. Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat there. When the kinsman redeemer he had mentioned came along, Boaz said, "Come over here, my friend, and sit down." So he went over and sat down. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, "Sit here," and they did so. Then he said to the kinsman redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our brother Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention." Literally it's not the brother, probably just a relative, just so you know, they weren't Elimelech's brothers, but brother in that general sense, like we say, hey, brother. All right, verse 4. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me, so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am next in line. I will redeem it, he said. Then Boaz said, on the day that you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth the Moabitess, you acquire the dead man's widow, that would be Ruth, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. At this, the kinsman redeemer said, then I cannot redeem it, because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it. Now, in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So the kinsman redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself, and he removed his sandal. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. Those were his sons. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from the town records. Today you are witnesses. Let's stop there and walk through that. So, let's just walk through this and figure out what actually is going on. So, verse 1, Boaz goes to the town gate. Now, in those days, you would have, you know, towns that would be walled. They'd be walled cities for protection. So, you might have land, fields out, you know, out there, but you probably lived inside the city walls. And the gate was kind of the hub of the city. If you wanted to find somebody, which is what Boaz is trying to do here, you'd go to the gate, because everyone has to go out in the morning to go out to their lands and work, and then they come back in through the gate. So it's where everybody's passing. It's where the local gossip happens. It's kind of the hub of things. It's also where business transactions take place, and even legal matters can be settled at the town gate. And so Boaz finds this near kinsman. And then my guess is he hand selects 10 guys that are called elders. They're just men of the town. And basically, he creates an ad hoc courtroom, okay, kind of a legal gathering that can actually legally make things happen if you've got 10 guys there. So they're kind of going through a business and legal transaction. So he's got his kind of courtroom to formalize this process that he wants to do. Did that make sense? Yeah? Okay, that came out kind of weird. In verse 1, when he says, come over here, my English translation says, my friend. Literally, in the Hebrew, it's a sort of an indefinite phrase. Like, in English, we say such and such, or we would say so and so. So, a good literal translation would be, come over here, Mr. So-and-so, and sit down. So I'm going to call him Mr. So-and-so. He remains anonymous through the story, and I think by the end it becomes apparent why he doesn't get a name in this story. So he calls Mr. So-and-so and says, sit down, and he brings this group of elders together to formalize this agreement that he wants to make. And we learn some great things about Boaz in this chapter. We already know, based on chapter 3, that he is willing to marry Ruth. He's willing to bring her and Naomi under his wing. We know that, but we learn something new in this chapter. We learn just how far he is willing to go to love these two women. And what he's going to do here is make sure that they are totally taken care of now and in the future, whether by him or somebody else. So we learn just how much his chesed extends to these two women. And the other thing we learn is that he's a pretty savvy guy, okay? You attorneys would be proud of Boaz in this moment. He does something pretty cool. And we saw Ruth and Naomi being really savvy in chapter 3. Now we see Boaz come into this scene, and he brings that same kind of savviness to this. Now, just as an aside before I go on, this you may not have thought of this before. It's very probable, not for sure, but it's very probable that Boaz and this other Mr. So-and-so, they may already have families of their own, okay, or at least sons of their own. It's possible that they're both married, and you probably don't think of Boaz as a married guy, and in our culture, and for obvious reasons, that seems very weird. It's possible that he's married. I would say it's probable that he already has sons. Maybe he's a widow himself. We just don't know. The reason I say that is because we know that this guy is a man of standing. He's a man of reputation, and in that culture, it'd be pretty tough to be that just as a single man. I mean, it's family and inheritance. That's what gives you that kind of standing. So it's at least very possible that Boaz already has sons, and this other guy already has sons of his own too. Okay, so just keep that in mind as we go through this. All right, so Boaz gathers these people. Now, based off of chapter 3, what are we expecting Boaz to ask this Mr. So-and-so? What are we expecting to ask him? What's that? Yeah, redeem Ruth, right? Will you marry Ruth? That's what we're expecting him to say. So verse 3 catches us off guard when he says, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our brother Elimelech. That comes out of the blue for us. We haven't heard about this land yet. We don't know why it hasn't been brought up. And why is Boaz bringing up the subject of land when we're expecting him to talk about Ruth? And I think it's all part of Boaz's plans to make sure that Ruth and Naomi are taken care of into the future. So just a little bit of background of the culture, and then we will continue with the story, I promise. In that time, you know, one of the core values we've already talked about is to continue the family line. So you want to have a male heir that can continue the family name. But alongside that, there's another core value that that family property remain within the family, at least over time. So we want to be able to keep the ancestral lands within the family clan if possible. And so God made provisions in the law when Israel came to the land that would keep lands or provide ways for lands to come back into families' hands. So let me read to you. This is from Leviticus 25. This is one of those laws. The land must not be sold permanently because the land is mine. This is the Lord speaking. And you are but aliens in my tenants. Throughout the country that you hold as a possession, you must provide for the redemption of the land. Okay, so what that means is basically, if a family had to sell their land, really what they were doing is they were selling an indefinite lease. Okay, another clansman would basically be purchasing an indefinite lease. I mean, they wouldn't be making payments on it. They would be able to use the land and profit from it. But the idea would be that somehow, ultimately, the land would eventually come back into the family's hands. So think of it as an indefinite lease. Next part of this verse. So if one of your countrymen becomes poor and sells some of his property to someone outside of the family, we would assume, his nearest relative is to come and redeem what his countryman has sold. So a relative should come and basically buy back the lease so that the land will remain in the extended family's hands. If, however, a man has no one to redeem it for him, but he himself prospers and acquires sufficient means to redeem it, he should buy back the land. He is to determine the value for the years since he sold it and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it. He can then go back to his own property. All right, so basically, if you sell the land, it's just this indefinite lease, and ideally, a kinsman, a family relative, if they can financially, they are obligated to buy back that lease so that it remains in family hands. So there's two possible options of what's taken place here. The first one is not the one I go for, but it's basically this. When Elimelech and Naomi were, when they were in Israel and they left for Moab, they never sold the land. Okay, and they've had the land since, so now Naomi's coming back, she's got this property, and now she wants to sell it. Okay, that's a possibility, and we read our English translation of, he's saying she wants to sell it and buy it, makes it sound like that's what's going on. But if you think about it, the question is, why are we just hearing about this now for the first time? I mean, if she's had this land this whole time, why when she comes back is she saying, I've come back completely empty, and why has Ruth been gleaning in someone else's fields and basically begging for the last couple months through the harvest? If they have their own fields, why isn't she just doing that, or why hasn't she sold it a while back so they could provide for themselves? Does that make sense? It seems strange that we'd be hearing this now. So my guess is that these English words that are to sell and to buy, they actually have a little bit more flexibility than that in the Hebrew. So my guess is that Elimelech did actually sell the field before he left for Moab and sold it to someone outside the clan. So that person now has this indefinite lease on the land, and they're the ones working it. They're the ones making a profit. And there's some third-party person that we haven't heard about, we don't hear about. And so what Boaz is saying here now is Naomi has come back, and as the wife of the deceased, she has the first right to redeem this property, to buy the lease back. But obviously, she can't because she has no money, right? So what she's doing is she's now transferring that right to the next closest relative, which is you, Mr. So-and-so, and she's asking for you, will you buy back the lease so that at least the land remains in the extended family's hands? That's what she's doing. Does that make sense? Okay, so I think that's what's going on. So he's saying, Mr. So-and-so, would you be willing to do this? And that would keep the land in the family's hands, and this guy has an obligation to do that, a la Leviticus 25. So what that would mean for Mr. So-and-so is basically this. It's going to be a huge financial cost for him, right? I mean, he's going to have to buy back this lease. He's going to have to gain whatever financial resources he has to buy this lease. It's going to be a huge cost to him. But when he does that, he gets the right to use the land and ultimately make a profit. So long-term, it's an asset for him. And the reality is Naomi, she is beyond age for bearing kids, so she's never going to have a son that will continue Elimelech's line. And this guy, Mr. So-and-so, he has no legal obligation to marry Ruth. Okay, he's not that close of a family member. He's not obligated. She's a foreigner. So she's not going to have a son in Elimelech's line. So essentially, there's no one in that line that will ultimately inherit this field that he's being asked to purchase. So when all is said and done, his own sons will end up getting this property, and the inheritance will go to them. So it's a short-term cost, but long-term, it's a great asset for him. So he looks at that, and he says at the end of verse 4, he says, yeah, I'll redeem that. And then Boaz, verse 5, plays the trump card. He says, oh, there is one more thing. There's one more thing. On the day you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth of Moabitess, you acquire the dead man's widow. You acquire Ruth in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. My guess is Mr. So-and-so already knows about Ruth. Okay, so it's not like Boaz is saying, I mean, the whole town knows about Ruth. It's not like Boaz is saying something that he hasn't heard. But here's what I think Boaz is saying. I think he's saying, you know, as nearest relative, Mr. So-and-so, you are preserving the family line, and that's really good. But if you want to be a true relative, if you really want to care for this family, these two women, not just do what you're obligated to do, but if you really want to go above and beyond and do what Chesed would call you to do, what you should do is you should acquire Ruth. You should marry Ruth, and you should give her a son. And that first son that you'll have will not be a son in your line. It will be a son in Mahlon and Elimelech's line. That would be the loving thing to do. And that son will be the one to inherit this land over time. That's what he's asking Mr. So-and-so to do. And when he says that, this land, which is a potential long-term asset, becomes a huge, huge long-term liability. Because not only is he going to have to pour money into this thing, he's going to have to pour energy into it, and then ultimately, it's not even going to go to his family. Ultimately, all of that work, all that energy, all those finances are going to go to this other son who will be born, and it'll go to someone that is not his direct line. So it's going to cost him so much, and he doesn't get a long-term reward from it. And the brilliance of this, in terms of Boaz, is that he's bringing this up in public. he's raising this issue and saying, here's what Chesed would call you to do, and he's doing it in front of all these guys. And if he hadn't done that, Mr. So-and-so could have just bought the field and not married Ruth. But now this larger act of love is being raised in public. So now if he buys the field and doesn't marry Ruth, now he looks like a selfish jerk in front of everybody. And so his option is he's either got to do it all or he's got to basically concede everything to Boaz and say, you do this. And Mr. So-and-so looks at the options and he opts for obviously option number two. Verse 6, at this the kinsman redeemer said, then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. The cost to my own estate is so high to do this that I'm not going to do it. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it. And of course, this cost is so high, and that is the cost that Boaz is willing to make for Ruth and Naomi. He's willing to spend this money to work the land and then ultimately see this land go not to his direct line, but to another man's direct line. And that is Chesed. That's the steadfast love. So I want to just walk pretty quickly, basically just read the rest of this chapter. So they formalize this thing. There's some sandal ceremony that you do back then. I don't think that happens today in business transactions. Not sure. But he basically, you know, Mr. So-and-so hands his sandal to Boaz, probably symbolizing the transfer of that right in some symbolic way to Boaz. And then Boaz says in verse 9, in front of all these witnesses, "Today you are witnesses that I bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property." So I'm preserving both the family line and the family land so that his name will not disappear from among the records. And then in verse 11 and 12, you have the men in the town just blessing Boaz for his actions. "Then the elders and all those who are at the gate," verse 11, "said, 'We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you have many children," basically. "May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem." That becomes more true than they would ever guess. "Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." And then verse 13, "So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son." It's possible that actually Ruth, until this time, hadn't been able to conceive. She may have been married up to 10 years in Moab and hadn't had a child up to that point. So this may be a fairly miraculous birth. It's hard to say. But either way, the Lord enables her to conceive. And then you have the women of the town praising and blessing Naomi. Verse 14, "The women said to Naomi, 'Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer.'" Now, I think the redeemer they're talking about now is the son that was just born. He's going to be a relative who ends up taking care of her and helping, and that'll be apparent in the next couple verses. "May this son," I'm arguing, "may he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." And then it ends with Naomi and this child. "Then Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap, and cared for him. The women living there said, 'Naomi has a son.' And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David." And since you didn't read the genealogy, I won't either. I'll save that for next week. So that's the story of Ruth. And pretty great story, and we've got another week to cover it. But I want to spend some time reflecting on this chapter and really some of the whole story. And again, as I've been arguing, as I said at the beginning, I think it becomes clear as you look at the end that the story is not so much a romance, that it really is an adventure. It really is this drama. And that becomes clear at the end. What's been driving this plot is not the romance between Ruth and Boaz, but the problem of Naomi, of her loss, and her devastation, and then the chesed that's been shown to her that brings her to a place of fullness. And I think that's really clear as you look at how the way this story ends, okay? It doesn't end with Ruth and Boaz walking off into the sunset, right? They kind of, after verse 13, they kind of disappear. It ends with Naomi and a son, because that's the resolution of the plot. That was the problem all along, and that is the resolution of the plot. And so you see in verse 17, the women actually say, "Naomi has a son." Now, the son is not literally Naomi's, right? Ruth is the one who gave birth. But essentially, she and Boaz have done that in order to preserve Naomi's husband's family line. They're like surrogate parents that have provided a son for Naomi. And so the women recognize that and say, "You now have the son that you didn't have before." In verse 16, it says, "Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap, and cared for him." And that language is really, she's going to become the caretaker of Obed. She's going to become the grandma nanny, basically, of Obed. And as it says in verse 15, "He's going to renew your life. He's going to sustain you. This little boy, as he grows, will provide fullness for Naomi as she grows older, and he'll protect her." So in light of that, that the story is really about the resolution of Naomi's problem, I want to spend the rest of our time reflecting one more time on this concept of chesed. And really from the perspective primarily of Naomi and the problem of Naomi. And I want to look at three angles of chesed in this story. The first angle is this, that clearly Ruth and Boaz have been these amazing pictures of chesed to Naomi, haven't they? I mean, these two people who are very different. One, this foreign woman who has no power, this and this Jewish man who's got standing, but these two people who come together and see a woman in need. And they come together to perform this rescue operation for her, basically. And they exhibit this steadfast love and commitment to her that is costly at times and very risky at times and really out of the box. All this to give this love to this woman in need. And I think of Ruth. I want you to think of Ruth one more time. Picture her story, okay? Put yourself in her shoes. She's this Moabite woman who grew up in Moab, incidentally. And one day, this foreign family from Israel comes into her town, into her culture and her setting, and they end up getting connected, and she ends up marrying one of the sons. And they come from a different religion, a different culture, and she marries into this family. And then the unthinkable happens. All three men, both sons and the father, die. And she's left without a husband, and her mother-in-law is left without a man in her life. And her mother-in-law decides to return to her homeland. And in the midst of that, Ruth makes this radical decision. In the midst of her family, in the midst of her culture, in the midst of her neighborhood, everything that she knows, she says, I'm going to stick with my mother-in-law, this woman in deep need who is totally alone. I'm going to stand by her, and more importantly, I'm going to stick with her God. And clearly, God was at work in her heart. But I'm going to attach myself to her, and I'm going to commit myself to her, and we're going to be two women who are powerless without anything, but I'm going to stand by her and stand by her God. And so she goes to a land that she doesn't know with a mother-in-law. And then she gets there, and her mother-in-law is depressed and really just unable to do anything. So she says, you know what? I'm going to go out to the fields, and I'm going to work the fields for my mother-in-law. And I'm going to do this tiresome, back-breaking work of pulling, you know, grains out and providing for her. And then when they come across this man, Boaz, and Naomi comes up with a plan that's really out of the box, very risky, very different, she says, I will do that. I will put myself in a very risky situation for the sake of my mother-in-law, because this man is part of her family, her relative, and he can do something about her situation. So I'm gonna step out and do that. And she shows this just radical chesed, this gutsy, risky, courageous woman, very much the female version of Abraham, the man of faith who stepped out. And you see that in Ruth, stepping out for the sake of her mother-in-law. And I love the last words that are spoken of her in verse 15. The women say, she is truly better to you than seven sons. And Ruth has been better than seven sons for Naomi. You think of what sons are supposed to do for their mothers, protect and provide and care. She's done all of that for her mother-in-law. And then I think of Boaz, this wealthy Jewish man of standing and character and clout, who one day is just in his fields, and he happens to see this foreigner begging in his fields, gleaning in his fields, and he's heard the story about her, and he sees her, says, I am going to watch out for that woman. I'm gonna protect her, I'm gonna provide for her, I'm going to be watching out for her. And he does that. And then one night, on the threshing floor, he wakes up, and there she is, at the foot of his feet. And she says in so many words, will you marry me? And she says, I want to come under your care and protection. And here's a guy, a respectable guy, who could have taken offense at that action and sees that, and sees behind that action this woman's commitment to her mother-in-law. And he says, you right now, I see that what you're doing is an act of chesed to your mother-in-law. So I will do what you ask. I will bring you under my care. And then as we see today, he goes into his world of men and business, and he uses his clout and his power to do everything to make sure that these two women are cared for. And so when Mr. So-and-so backs out, he takes on this very costly sacrifice for the sake of these women. You got these two people who come together and show this amazing, steadfast love to Naomi. And you've also got these two foils, these two kind of counter-heroes in the story. You have Mr. So-and-so, and then in chapter 1 we had, who is the foil to Ruth? Yeah, the other daughter-in-law. What's her name? Orpah. Yeah, Orpah. Great name. You have Orpah and Mr. So-and-so, and they function. Orpah was the daughter-in-law who, when Naomi said, you know what, girls, you should go back to Moab. You should stay with your family. You can have husbands there. Essentially, she obeyed her mother-in-law and said, okay, and she went back. And then you have Mr. So-and-so. When he saw the cost of what everything would require, he said, you know what, Boaz, you can do that. And I think the narrator intentionally has them in the story, not so much to point out how selfish those two were, how unloving and uncaring and just self-centered they were, but actually precisely to point out how normal they were. they do the thing that you'd expect anybody to do in their circumstance. They do what would be expected. They do what most of us probably would do if we were in their circumstance. And I think they're there to show us just how radical Chesed truly is. Chesed is that love that goes beyond expectations, goes beyond what you would expect in the ordinary. And that's what Ruth and Boaz have been for Naomi. She's experienced this radical Chesed through these two people. And so I think about that, and this is the last time that we'll talk about Chesed, but I think it's an opportunity for us to look at our own lives in light of their story and say, where are the opportunities in my life for me to give that same kind of chesed, steadfast love, to those in my life? Who are the Naomis in my life right now? Those people that are in need, that need a friend, or that need a parent, that need whatever. Who are those people? I encourage you even to think right now, who are the people God has put in my life that I have the opportunity to love in a surprising way, to love in a way that maybe goes beyond what they would be expecting from me right now? That's, I think, one of the core encouragements that this story offers us. So that's the first angle of chesed that I want to talk about. The second is the most important, and it is not Ruth and Boaz's love for Naomi, but it's God's love for Naomi. It's God's commitment and God's chesed to Naomi. And I think when you get to the end of the story, as she looks back at this, at her life, she doesn't just see Ruth and Boaz. She sees God working through all of this. Verse 14, the women say to Naomi, praise be, not to Ruth and Boaz, but praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. They're saying, God has provided a son for you. And she gets to see this son, and he is a tangible expression of God's faithfulness to her. And all along, it was God who was working. It was God who gave her the gift of Ruth and who worked in Ruth's heart to give her this radical commitment, this really miraculous commitment to her mother-in-law. That was God working. And it was God who raised up Boaz and brought him at the right time and place and made him the man of character that he was, that he would provide for them. And it was God working in the circumstances of Naomi's life. You remember in chapter 2, Ruth goes out to the field, and the narrator says she just happened to come into Boaz's field. And we know that she didn't just happen to, but we know that God was at work in that, bringing her into Boaz's field. And then, of course, in verse 13, it's God who enables Ruth to conceive and give birth to a son. All along, it was God who was working. And Naomi now gets to step back and see that. And she sees that through pain and through loss and through setbacks and through roadblocks and through this windy road of life, the God that she believed in has remained faithful. And this God who she was very angry with in chapter 1 and that she was depressed and disappointed with and voiced that, he had room for that. And he remained faithful to her. And she gets to see that faithfulness being played out as she sees the birth of Obed. And so I think, as I look at that, this is again an opportunity for us to ask ourselves, how do I need to be reminded of God's chesed in my own life? Where do I need to be reminded of his faithfulness, his commitment to me? And I think maybe there's two ways that we can do that. One is just to say, is to proactively ask yourself, where have I seen God at work in my life? Maybe just take some time and say, I just want to be reminded of God's faithfulness. So I want to look back and just see, God, where have I seen you at work in my life? I want to give thanks to you. I want to be grateful for the ways that I've seen your faithfulness. And this past week, I've been trying this experiment. I go running like maybe 4 or 5 days a week. I keep that 175-pound weight down to about 130. And I've been my experiment has been I'm doing gratitude runs. I only run for like 15 minutes, but I'm just spending that time to be grateful and just what are the things I'm grateful for? Oh, I'm thankful that I have a body that moves. I'm thankful for the place I live. I'm thankful for my wife. I'm thankful for my family. I'm thankful. And then I get into deeper things. You know, more importantly, God, I'm thankful for what you've done in my life, for Jesus Christ. Just that act of gratitude, of acknowledging God's chesed in our lives is so powerful. And I think this story encourages us to do that. And of course, the other way is to consider the hard things in our lives right now. And I know that many of you are going through really difficult things that none of us know about. And you're going through difficult things in your family, or at work, certainly, financially, all sorts of really difficult things where you're scared, you're sad, or there's some future thing that you're wrestling with and you're trying to figure out what to do with it, and you're wondering about God's faithfulness and you're just feeling that anxiety. And this story encourages us to remember, even in those moments, yeah, God is faithful. God will be faithful to us, and God will see us through. Reminds us of what Paul says in Romans 8, that God is working in all things, bringing about good, bringing about our ultimate good, forming the character of Christ in us. He who began a good work will be faithful to complete it. And many of you need that encouragement today. And this is a great story that encourages us of that. And then finally, this last picture, God's greatest picture of chesed, actually, we find not by looking back in the story, but by looking forward in the story. And the end of this story encourages us to look forward. And it ends with this genealogy, of course, that says that Boaz and Ruth give birth to a son, and he ends up being the grandfather of none other than King David. And the original audience would hear that, and they'd be like, yes, that's why we have this story. This is the ancestry of King David. And today we can look at this and say, it not only points forward to the great king of Israel, King David, but the greatest king, Jesus Christ, who comes in this line. And so what we see is Ruth and Boaz are in the line of Jesus Christ. And so I look at Boaz particularly today as this kinsman redeemer, and how he points forward to Jesus Christ, who is the ultimate kinsman redeemer, the ultimate one who came for his people and redeemed them. I think of Boaz in this story, a man of strength and character who sees these two women who culturally are powerless and helpless without a voice, and he sacrifices so much to bring them under his wing. And I like, what a great picture that is of Jesus Christ. Christ who sees us, and we are helpless and powerless. And I want to show you Ephesians 2. We're beyond helpless. Christ sees this. This is Paul speaking to the Ephesians. You think of Ruth and Naomi and their situation. Look at the situation that we were in. Just reminding you of this. As for you, we weren't just helpless. You were dead in your transgressions and sins. You were unable to respond to God. In which you used to live, when you followed the ways of this world and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit, that's the Satan, who is now at work in those who are disobedient. You weren't just dead, you were slaves. You were slaves to the world, you were slaves to Satan. And then he says, like the rest, all of us, we were by nature objects of God's wrath. God's holy, steady opposition to sin was upon us. So we were dead, we were slaves, and we were objects of God's wrath. And Christ, our Redeemer, sees that. He sees us in that helpless state, and he redeems. He rescues. Just like Boaz rescues these two women. And of course, there's a couple key differences between Boaz and Jesus. One is that for Jesus, the cost was so much higher than it was for Boaz. Boaz had this huge financial cost, this cost of time and energy and resources. But for Christ, the cost was everything. And today we're going to celebrate communion to close our service. The cost is represented here in these broken pieces of bread and this juice that represents his broken body and his blood. The cost was his life. And the other main difference was for Boaz, these two women came into his life and asked him to do something radical, and he responded in this gracious way. But Christ didn't respond to us. Christ initiated with us. Christ didn't wait for us to come and say, we need your help. While we were sinners, Christ came into the world. In fact, before any of us were born, Christ initiated that redemption and came to us and did everything. He didn't respond. He initiated. And so he is the ultimate kinsman redeemer. And I think of his words in Luke. I'll close with these words. No, I won't. I'll almost close with these words. His words in Luke 13 that reflect the language of Boaz, and you guys know this, he says, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings." And it's that same picture used in Ruth of bringing us under his wings of protection. And the way he does that is by dying for us, by giving his life, by freeing us from our sins, by rescuing us, protecting us from God's steady wrath. And then he says in Matthew 11, "Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, I'll give you rest. Come under my wings, and I will give you rest." And he is God's ultimate picture of chesed to us. So I think as the story points forward to him, it encourages us, and I want to encourage you as we enter into communion to end the service, to consider, how do you need to come to Jesus this morning? As we come to these tables, what are the ways that you need to come to Christ, to come under his protection, under his wings again? And maybe you look back the last couple months, and you look at your life, and you just see, I've kind of just been doing life on my own. I've kind of just been doing my own thing. I've been places I shouldn't. There are things that I'm doing that I shouldn't be doing, and I'm feeling some of the weight of that. And maybe today you just need to come under Jesus' wings and find forgiveness in his sacrifice. And remember again that what Christ has done for us covers everything that we have done or ever will do. Or maybe you've been striving these last couple months. Maybe you've just been trying so hard to earn God's approval or people's approval, and you just feel like you've been striving, and maybe you need to just come and rest under Jesus' wings and recognize, you know what? I can't earn God's approval. People's approval doesn't matter. What matters is that Christ has sacrificed his life for me and that I'm good with God because of that. So maybe you need to do that. So I invite you to consider as we celebrate communion, how do you need to come to Jesus this morning? And we've got our six stations, four in the front, two in the back. So in a minute, I'll close in prayer. And then you can go to one of the tables and you can take a piece of bread and you can dip it in the cup and then you can eat it there, or you can take it back to your seat. And Tim and the folks will come up and lead us in some worship. So let me close in a word of prayer. Well, Father, we thank you for the story of Ruth. More importantly, we thank you for your chesed. We thank you that through everything we experience, the difficult, the painful, the frustrating, and the joyful, that you remain faithful and that you're working all these things in our lives for your glory and for our good to make us more and more like Jesus Christ. Most importantly, we thank you today for him. We thank you that he is our great kinsman redeemer who has brought us under his wings and done that by giving up his life for us. Thank you that you find that sacrifice acceptable and that we are right with you, not because of anything we do or ever will do, but because of what he's done for us. So thank you that we can come to this table this morning in total freedom as your kids, filled with your spirit, loved by you because of what your son has done for us. And I ask that you work in our hearts wherever we need to be reminded of your love this morning, that you, through your spirit, would do some work. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.